Hello and welcome to the Responsible Management Podcast from the University of Bradford School of Management. My name's David Spicer. I'm the Director of Business and Community Engagement here at the school and delighted to be hosting yet again our podcast today. We're talking today about inclusion and wellbeing, and I'm delighted that we're joined by three contributors. We've got Dr. Samantha Cross. Samantha is Associate Professor of Marketing and the F.W. Olin Distinguished Chair of Global Business, Babson College in the US. Her research examines cultural and sensory influences and societal forces on consumption, decision-making and innovation. And she has a particular interest in how diverse identities, perspectives, beliefs and abilities coexist in consumers, households and the marketplace. Our second contributor is Sharon Sanders. Sharon is Digital Inclusion Programme Manager for Bradford Metropolitan District Council, and she's over 20 years of experience in delivering improved services for customers and efficiency savings across the public and the private sector. And then last but by no means least, our third contributor is Professor Eva Kipnis. Eva is Professor of Marketing here at Bradford. Her research interests include culture-informed consumer behaviour and cultural meanings conveyed by brands, diversity and inclusion engaged marketing, and the use of socially inclusive technologies in product and service innovations. Delighted to be talking to you all today. The focus of the podcast is around responsible management. So we'll start off with that as an open question. What does responsible management mean for you? Samantha, would you like to go first?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that quite a bit because, you know, of course, we're going to be talking here about responsible management. And I wondered, I looked up different definitions, et cetera, and wondered, you know, what exactly does it mean out there? And I came across something that I thought was interesting. And out of that, I thought, well, you know, it's really about the actions that you take as a manager. It's really about the sort of leadership that you're showing in terms of management. And it's about meeting expectations, I think, of all the stakeholders involved. And that could be everything from your investors, your employees, your consumers. And of course, as a marketer, my focus tends to be on the marketplace and looking at all of the different players in the marketplace, not just some to the exclusion of others. So to me, that's, you know, when I think about responsible management, I think about all of those things.
I was thinking about responsible management definition today as well as I was coming to the university. And I thought that actually it can be interpreted in two ways. One, do no harm. That's responsibility. But is this enough? Or is responsible management about do no harm and do some good? So to me, it is the latter. But I do think that responsibility is a term that allows for this sort of opacity, so to speak. And I think I very much agree with your perspective, Samantha, that action is really important. So it is responsibility with action, not responsibility with an action.
Yeah, I'd agree with that because what I was thinking about was as responsible leaders, because in essence, that's what we're also talking about, we shouldn't just think about what it is that we're doing for our organisation, but it's also what can we do for others within the communities in which our organisation engages. So, for example, within the public sector, clearly you're supporting a location, and therefore what are the things that we can do that are contributing positively directly into the lives of those within the communities that we serve?
Brilliant. I think that segues potentially then into our topic today around inclusion and kind of wellbeing. If we're thinking about engaging with multiple stakeholders, thinking about all the different kind of actors in a particular situation, the communities that we kind of deal with, that ties, I assume, to inclusion, certainly as a kind of concept. So when we say inclusion and wellbeing, what do we mean by that? And what's the kind of focus there for business? Sharon, do you want to lead on that one?
The passion that I have, as I know you know, David, is around digital inclusion. As our world moves more and more towards digital solutions and engagement for services, we really, really need to think about the impact of those who are digitally excluded. And often they are those who are experiencing health poverty, social poverty, it may be disability. So they're often in cohorts that are already challenged with life. And digital inclusion adds a different layer to that. So for me, ensuring that there is a consideration for those who are digitally excluded when we're specifically looking at services that we're wanting to promote via digital platforms, and our ability to give back to those individuals to help them to engage with our services is really, really important. And I think that's a key factor that has to be taken into consideration.
I really like Sharon's point, if I can add to it, about, I mean, you'd mentioned before positive contributions and then this idea of giving back. So I think it's really about considering everyone who can be affected by your actions as a manager, as an institution. And that might be those that you're directly connecting with, but it might be others as well, that perhaps it's not as direct and either they're feeling excluded or they're affected in some way. So I really like that aspect as well.
Sometimes well-being is considered as something linked to health more than anything else, whereas I see a very direct link between inclusion and social well-being. And for me, inclusion is provision of access, but also accommodating for the variety of different people's characteristics and circumstances. And as Samantha was saying, not only thinking about this is my target market, but also thinking about everybody else who may not be your target market as an organization, but will be impacted by what an organization is doing.
You know, COVID was a game changer for me personally, because my husband has leukemia and therefore he is immune compromised. So the only way I can engage with the world, and this is how we still operate now, we're still in essence shielding, is through that digital connection. But the rest of the world has moved on. And I'm not suggesting that they should stop their lives because we're in this situation, but I'm extremely aware that there will be many others who are in similar situations to myself and my husband, who are not as privileged as we are in terms of their access to the support that they need, including that digital support, to enable them to engage with services and organisations that then can support them with their daily life. And I think that's really something to raise, because it is at risk as we move further away from the pandemic. It's at risk of being lost as a lesson. And, you know, people start to go on with their lives, which I'm delighted for. And I live vicariously through their holiday snaps. However, you know, having that awareness that we're not all in the same privileged position, and that sometimes there has to be some adjustment to services to meet the needs of others, is really important.
To bring that back to business perspective, I guess that applies equally for commercial organisations as it does for kind of public sector organisations. And in essence, what's the business case here? Why should we be concerned about inclusion and well-being from a business perspective?
You can think about it in two ways, I would say. One is the market logic. And very often businesses do not consider the value of the market they're losing by not catering by a particular population or a particular social group. The most recent research project Samantha and I have been working on together, people with food allergies. And by 2030, 1 in 5 people will have a food allergy. So how can a restaurant operate effectively if they do not have procedures catering for people with food allergies? Because ultimately, there is data suggesting that people with allergies, if they have concerns about safety of food service, they leave the restaurant. So ultimately, it is lost financial value that businesses cannot make if they don't accommodate for this category of people. There is also an element that the young labor workforce entering the labor market now, over 50% of young labor workforce in the UK tend not to apply to corporations and organizations that they don't believe are inclusive in their approach as employers. So there is direct implication for the type of employees an organization is able to recruit. And then, of course, there is a social logic to it as well. It's they're doing the right thing. And again, doing good rather than doing no harm. So that's how I see it.
No, I was just going to say, I think, Eva, you covered that really well. I think I would add, just in addition, it's not just employee expectations or potential employee expectations, but it's the consumer and wider societal expectations as well. I think it's really hard for business in this day and age to say we are unconcerned about all of these other aspects, even if that's not your particular target market. So I think that it's not just the value you're leaving on the table, but also the societal expectation that you need and should be considering all of these different potential stakeholders who could be affected by your actions. And I think tied to that are the consequences of your actions. Whatever it is you're doing, what are the long, not just short-term effects, but the long-term effects of those things, even perhaps not in this sphere, perhaps your regional sphere or location or anything like that, geographical sphere, but even wider. So I think that those are expectations as well. So I agree with you, Eva, it's those market and social logics for sure.
I think another thing to factor in is the situation whereby looking at what the lived experiences of not just your employees, but the people with whom you're engaging. So I don't know if you've seen on the TV, but there is an advert at the moment that's the Good Things Foundation in BT, right? And it's about data poverty. Now, that on its own is lovely. It's a nice advert and it's great. But ultimately, what that's telling us is there are at least 8 million households across the country that do not have access to digital platforms, right? So therefore, as an organisation, you have to factor in that there have to be other ways for people to engage with you, not just digital, so that you are being more inclusive. Because in addition to those sorts of poverty challenges, you will also have some people who, for a variety of reasons, will never, ever engage with you digitally. They will want to have some other form. So by not accommodating and being aware of that, then you're actually cutting off a potential revenue stream from your own organisation, if you're a revenue stream. If you're public sector, then potentially you're at danger of, you know, like the NHS, for example, pushing the NHS app, you're at danger of isolating patients, for example, even further. So there has to be a mixed model, I would suggest.
Brilliant. So it's about recognising the diversity of needs that employees, consumers, clients, the communities that we work with have, and responding to that diversity rather than just assuming that everybody works in the same kind of way. I'm struck, we're running a simulation at the moment with some of our students where they're running a business virtually, and one team were very disappointed that their marketing strategy had failed completely. And I looked at their marketing strategy with them and I said, well, you know, what have you done? And they said, oh, we put all our money in social media because everybody's on social media. And I'm like, who are you selling to? Who are your buyers? Yeah. Think about the environment that you're operating in. Yeah, if it's people like me, I'm not all over social media. I'm not going to find you through those kind of routes. Yeah, and there's a sort of light bulb moment for them there about, oh, right, maybe it's not everybody is exactly like us.
That's a good point, David. And I think also it's not even that everyone may or may not be on social media, but what are people doing with social media? So people may be on social media, but some of them are not necessarily purchasing through a particular channel or another channel. They may be purchasing in more traditional ways. So I think you have a good point there. Hopefully your students are learning that that they really have to consider, you know, access and behavior.
Definitely, definitely.
And sometimes innovation in the way that we deliver services can actually widen that exclusion gap. Because you're adding another component in that pushes that gap to be wider, when actually what you thought you might be doing is mitigating that gap. So again, it's that, you know, consideration for those decisions and the impact that they have in a wider context.
There is a concept, even if I'm allowed to sneak in an academic term, called pathogenic vulnerability that arises through as an unintended consequence of mitigating an original vulnerability. So, for example, you wanted to resolve someone's digital exclusion, and yet you excluded them more through digital innovation. So there is a concept that talks about it.
I'm just cutting into the podcast to tell you a little bit about the offer that we have for businesses locally as part of the business and community engagement support. We have our Knowledge Transfer Network, that's regular networking events where you can come on campus, meet like-minded people, hear from some of our and leading industry experts. We have our Bradford Business Challenge projects, where we have students coming out and working with you and supporting the work that you do. We have our consultancy clinic, where we have students delivering on short-term small projects for businesses as well. There's also lots of ways that you can engage with and interact with our students as guest lecturers, as mentors on some of our entrepreneurship programs, and through involvement in the curriculum. And equally, from a research perspective, we can work with you on collaborative research. If you think there's something we can help with, please reach out to us at BACE, that's base BACE, at bradford.ac.uk. Thank you, and now back to the podcast. Podcast, the conversation today follows on from a workshop hosted here at the university recently with Multicultural Marketplaces Network that was about inclusion and wellbeing in practice. Can you talk a little bit about what the network is about and what some of the key insights and takeaways from that workshop were?
So Multicultural Marketplaces Network is a community of researchers that is an international community. Samantha and I currently are co-leading this network, and we have colleagues from the UK, USA, Italy, Denmark, who are collaborating currently. So this is our current setup. And we had colleagues from France and several other countries as well. So the network ultimately is about understanding the, in Sharon's words, lived experiences of people, people, brands and organizations who live in this culturally diverse place that we call our world. It can be in different countries. It can be in different contexts. We have done a lot of projects together, but we also all have our individual expertise on different dimensions of diversity. So, for example, I looked at individuals who grew up multicultural, and Samantha has worked on multicultural households and also multiracial individuals as well. Some of our colleagues work in, for example, examining experiences of people with disability or LGBTQ plus consumers, and also various intersections of these different diversity dimensions. Samantha, do you want to continue a little bit talking about the network?
Yeah, I was just going to add, Eva, I think you gave a nice summation there of the network. I was thinking that one of our goals really is to bring those academic insights together with those practitioner sorts of experiences and hoping that in doing so, we can, as we said, create positive experiences for consumers and other organizations in our wider multicultural marketplaces. So that's really one of our underlying goals. So even if our publications may be reflective of more of our academic activities, the network's activities are a little bit wider in terms of bringing some of those academic insights that we've had to the attention of practitioners in that space who might be interested in using those insights or building from those insights. And I think that that's a really nice goal of the network, especially because we are based in different locations. So in some ways, those multi-perspectives help to mitigate some of the biases of being solely in the US or solely in the UK or solely having only those experiences.
And that actually leads very nicely to us talking about the workshop, because this is part of what the network does. We try to hold these practitioner engagement workshops in different locations. So recently it was in Bradford, and we were delighted to host a number of community organizations, representatives from Bradford and around Bradford, to really also learn about the work that is happening in Bradford. Bradford is one of the most multicultural marketplaces, I would say, in the UK. So it was a perfect location to explore some of the issues, so to speak, that we are focused on, but also to learn about the fantastic work that has been happening in terms of innovation and encouraging intercultural engagement. Also, Bradford is about to host Bradford City of Culture 2025, which also will be showcasing the richness and the variety and diversity of different cultures who are here living together in Bradford. So it was a very, very inspirational workshop, I would say.
It's back to that inclusion and well-being about social and personal engagement, isn't it? That the more engaged we are, the more inclusive we are, yeah, the more communities we're kind of working with, and there's benefits for ourselves as well as the externalities there. One of the themes from the workshop was around inclusion as co-production. What does that mean? How does that work?
I can speak from a digital inclusion perspective. So we have run sessions within our communities, across our some of our voluntary community sector organisations, literally to enable us to hear the voice of those who are digitally excluded. So it's not us sitting in a building going, people digitally excluded, this is what they need to have. It's actually, what are the challenges that you're facing and what barrier does you being digitally excluded present to you? And what would you like to see the solutions provided to you in a format? So some families will say, you know, schools expect us to engage with them digitally all the time. I can't afford the data. I don't really can do that. But they feel that they're missing out. So what is it that you need? Well, actually, we need to know how we can get more data. Okay, well, this is how we can support you with that. So it helps you to understand the lived experience of those individuals on the ground and helps us to formulate what interventions we can put in place to support them. And a good example of that is the devices that we gave out through the pandemic to children and young people across the district, over 3,000 devices. And some of those devices weren't logged into because parents felt apprehensive about their skills and their abilities. So actually, that gave us a really, really good indicator as to where we needed to target some support, because parents felt out of kilter. When the child wasn't online, they could pretend they had the same knowledge level as the child. Once the child's online and they're away and we're and they're staying here, they can no longer wing it. So actually, putting something in place that supports them to become more empowered was really important. But that's great feedback. And it doesn't just have to be in face-to-face sessions. It can be different feedback methodology that you use, whether that's surveys or whatever else, to help you build a picture of what the challenge is on the ground and then enable you as a business to understand what are some of the things that we could do that could remove those issues.
I think one important aspect that you have highlighted, that nobody can make another one included without collaborating with other one and understanding really this other person or people. But also for me, co-production was exactly what you were talking about when giving the example of Virgin Media. None of us, we are all social beings and we live a lot of our life in the marketplace. We work in organizations, we shop from organizations, we get services from organizations. So it's this mundane everyday life that produces inclusion, and it's produced through collaboration. The council cannot do digital inclusion on their own completely. So I would imagine you're collaborating with community groups as well as private organizations, as well as maybe with some charities and NGOs. So it's a collective effort that then leads to this great output of digital inclusion.
Oh, I was just going to add, Sharon, what I liked about this was this idea that, you know, inclusion is more than just having access or having the seat at the table or having the product or the service being made available to you, that it's also that perhaps intellectual sort of connection when we think of co-production. I think of, are we inviting those voices to give their perspectives on whether or not this works or it doesn't work and why? Are we thinking about that emotional aspect? You know, I think you're alluding to some of that, Sharon, where you feel like, oh, I can't do this. This is not for me. Are we thinking of even physical access? And that's what we tend to think about, but physical in a lot of ways. Do I not actually how to do this? The practical aspects of it. Do I know how to do it? Can I get on there in some form or fashion? So I think all of those things come into play when we think about co-production. And then I think, and I tell my students this sometimes, that it's not just who is using or buying your product, but who is not. And that tells us a whole lot about what kind of market we have, what kind of product we have, where the potential lies. And so I think that, you know, a lot of those things are raised there for sure, especially when you're looking at digital inclusion and those examples.
So, you know, at the end of the day, the provision of a SIM card and the provision of a device, that's not the answer on its own. It's what was the problem you were trying to solve for that individual by the provision of the SIM card, the device, or the skills, right? And that is the important thing, because, again, that's back to the core of the individual. What's their driver and their motivation for engaging digitally?
That's really great. I'm sort of reflecting on the network nature of this, that we're building an argument to say that inclusion and wellbeing is about understanding the network in which we're operating and the interconnected nature of that. There's possibly an aside in there from a change management perspective about how often do we implement technology and not think about its use, but we'll leave that one to one side for today, I think. Just coming back to that kind of network point, our particular focus is around SMEs. So the Knowledge Transfer Network that this podcast primarily services is a network of small and medium-sized enterprises. Where do SMEs fit in that kind of network? Because they're not public sector, they're not big corporate, they're not the universities. What are the kind of particular challenges, opportunities from SME around inclusion?
I think there's some good opportunities for SMEs around digital inclusion, because at the end of the day, they are also employers within the communities. So ultimately, they're wanting to attract students, people who would like to work with them. In order to do that, you need to be cognizant of some of the challenges from the areas in which you're trying to pull resource. So there are opportunities for them to become involved in digital inclusion networks. I've now got a digital inclusion officer that's looking at how we work up some of those digital inclusion networks, so we can share some understanding from their perspective as to what type of skills they're looking for. We can then support that sort of skill delivery. A lot of them may well be in the network from CTE, the Skills House within the council. But ultimately, there are also opportunities for us to talk to those organisations around when they're updating their technology and devices. How could we look at how they could donate some devices into the communities to actually support that digital inclusion agenda, and therefore building the skills in the communities and the employability side of it? So I think they are important. They are often local organisations. They are contributing to the local economy. So for me, they're an important part of it.
I would also add that there are, first of all, there are some really fantastic SMEs who are utilising technology to enhance inclusion. In particular, I want to highlight several SMEs that have been developing apps focused on women's health, menopause, and providing this information. We have been observing this discourse about the biases within the medical perspectives on female body versus a male body. So these SMEs are providing a very important social service, as well as obviously building their business. It's a really important social service, I would say. At the same time, I think the opportunity exists for SMEs to build greater awareness by participating in programs like Sharon's, because, for example, if you are using the management teaching speak, brick and mortar SME, and you offer your office or your location for, I don't know, delivery of digital inclusion workshop or consultation or something, what you're also doing is you're building footfall and you're building awareness about your business. If you are more of an online business, again, by offering some online classes on CV writing or something like this, you're again increasing awareness about your presence.
And I was thinking, you know, no organization starts without being an SME to begin with. That's where you have to start. And so in many ways, engaging SMEs, they have both an advantage and a disadvantage in some ways. They're closer to the consumer. There are not so many levels in the organization as yet, you know, and everyone knows that if you're working with a very entrepreneurial sort of entity, that in many ways you wear many hats. So the employees are also being exposed to a wide range of skill sets, as well as a wide range of stakeholders, all of them. And that is advantageous because then they can understand what is happening in terms of these players in the marketplace. But at the same time, the disadvantage comes that maybe you're too close sometimes to this action. And so you have to understand, how can I assist? How can I be inclusive and think broader and wider in many ways as you're doing that? So I think that the size of the firm, the arguments may shift a bit, and maybe some of the priorities, I don't know if there's so much change or they're added priorities, but I'm not certain that things change completely. I think that what happens is your distance from that consumer, that shifts. And so you have to organize accordingly.
That's a good point. Thank you. What practical advice, takeaways for organizations seeking to develop better approaches in terms of their kind of inclusion, particularly, might we suggest? And where can they go for kind of advice and guidance on this?
So I think I will give an answer that I think Samantha and I, we both talked about before. So Samantha, feel free to add here. I think inclusion is quite a broad concept. So nobody, no organization will really, with their first action, improve inclusion of everyone. It's a difficult and also iterative process. But at the same time, where there's a will, there's a way. And I think making a start is important, and being open to learning, as Sharon was saying, from those you're seeking to serve, and also thinking more broadly about who you serve. Even if you're not selling to them, you're still serving them as a social entity. These are probably the first steps. In terms of going for or looking for guidance and advice, our Multicultural Marketplaces Network has a website with a number of examples and also reading list that people can read around if they want. But then there are also other organizations that offer support and advice. So, for example, the World Federation of Advertisers has a very useful guide on inclusive advertising. So there is support online available, but also there are many in-person events. If anyone is interested, they can follow events by our network, but then there are also others in the UK, US, and other countries as well that are organized around inclusion.
I was going to add to that, Eva, that, you know, I came across a very nice quote the other day, and it said, people don't leave companies, they leave their leaders. And I thought that was really interesting, that sometimes we overlook what's right in front of us, and sometimes we don't question what's right in front of us or ask questions of what's right in front of us. So sometimes in terms of being inclusive, perhaps ask your employees, what are some of the things that we could do to be more inclusive? Again, especially with SMEs, they are close to the marketplace, and they might have some good ideas that people don't often think about. Even some of the bigger organizations have started doing this. Certainly in the US, we have this Super Bowl that happens either around February, like January or February, it depends, in the US, and the ads on the Super Bowl, you know, some of those bigger organizations have been reaching out to their employees to say, what would be a good ad? And there's an example of one, I think, of a Pepsi ad where they reached an employee, and it was part of reaching the community of consumers who perhaps have more difficulty hearing. Either they can't hear at all or they have difficulty hearing. And it was a very clever ad. And so that was just one example that was given by a big organization. And I think asking the organization and those within your organization, as well as even your consumers as well, we do a lot of surveys of consumers. Do we do enough of employees asking them what would be best they think of the for the consumers in terms of being inclusive?
In terms of digital inclusion, I would recommend that SMEs look at the Good Things Foundation website, because that actually gives great insight. They are strong advocates for supporting digital inclusion. They engage with cross-party and they've done lots of research, but it gives you good information around what the situation is on the national level for digital inclusion. It also gives you the opportunities to highlight which locations are actually dealing with supporting digital inclusion, and they can then get engaged with that and they can register on that network. They can have access to grant funding. They can get access to the data bank and the free SIM cards, et cetera. So that's a good thing. And then obviously I'm very keen to talk to people in the Bradford district through my Bradford email, which we can share, can't we, David? So sharon.sanders@bradford.gov.uk. I'd be really happy to talk to you about becoming part of the Bradford network. But they're the two things that I would suggest.
That's brilliant. Thank you all. One kind of final question, which is a little bit shifting pace. We've asked all of our contributors over the series this question. Who's your management hero? That can be personal or professional, somebody who's inspired, influenced your thinking or your career. Who's had that impact?
I'd say from a national figure, if you like, a world global figure, I'd say Richard Branson has really interested me. I've read his books. I'm quite impressed at how he adapts to meet the different challenges through his various markets. And even, I think it's a resilience for me when things go wrong, how he knocks back, reframes and pushes on. And that's very much what I'm like in my tenacity. So I think I would say Richard Branson for me.
Brilliant. Thanks, Sharon. Samantha?
For me, it was a really hard one, you know, in terms of thinking of management, because I was thinking of the compilation of different people I've worked with and interacted with, and who's inspired some of the things. And I think it was pulling different pieces together. But one of it's a marketing sort of guru that I try to show different clippings, et cetera, to my students. And this is Seth Godin. And I think that he just has an unusual way of looking at the same sorts of problems that everyone else may have, and kind of trying to understand and share those insights with others. And so I don't know that he is a management figure per se, but I think that certainly in terms of being able to share some of his insights, et cetera, I tend to draw on him in my classroom to kind of perhaps address some little known topics that we know affect us all, but we don't think about as much.
Well, for me, I would say somebody who really influenced and continues to influence my thinking is Michelle Oliver, who is currently the Global Vice President for Brand and Purpose in Mars. I've started following her work when I have seen the campaign by Maltesers that really shifted the marketplace in terms of representation of people with disabilities, but also ethno-racial groups and LGBTQ+. It was a very clever campaign, but also major, I think, social change undertaking that Michelle spearheaded. And she, I greatly respect and admire.
Brilliant. Thank you all kind of very much. In terms of reaching out, if our listeners want to kind of contact you, Sharon, you've already given your email. If you just want to say that again, assuming you're fairly easily findable on the council website as well.
I'd say so. But yes, it's sharon.sanders@bradford.gov.uk.
Brilliant. Thank you. Samantha?
It's scross@babson.edu.
anybody that goes to the Babson College website will find you, I'm sure, very, very quickly as well.
Very easily.
Eva.
Yeah, it's e.kipnis, K-I-P-N-I-S, at bradford.ac.uk.
Brilliant. Similarly, if you want to reach out to us about the business and community engagement work here at the University of Bradford, you can find us on the website. I'm d.p.spicer at bradford.ac.uk, or you can contact us on BACE, that's Business and Community Engagement, the initials, BACE at bradford.ac.uk. Follow us on social media. It's at Brad Management or at Dave P. Spicer. Thank you all very much for your insights, your contributions. I've really enjoyed the conversation today. Thank you. If you've got a project that you'd love to get done, but you're struggling with the time and resources to do that, that's something that we can help you with. Bradford Business Challenge projects are where we get our students to do, as part of their dissertation, a piece of applied management work for a business like yourselves. Either one of our final year undergraduate or MSc students, with the support of an academic mentor, will be able to work on that project for you. There's no cost for you as a business. All we ask for you is to set up with us that project, give us a kind of outline brief that the student will go away and work into a full proposal for you, and then you'll be meeting and liaising with them and their academic advisor to get that project delivered. Because we have multiple students doing these over the course of the year, there's usually a group of students looking for any project at one time. So if that's something that you're interested in and you'd like to know more about, please reach out to us at BACE, base at bradford.ac.uk.